All right, welcome everybody. I'm going to call us to order on time only because we got a lot to cover. And I know others will file in momentarily, but thank you all for being on time. Very much appreciate that. That is the effort I know. Welcome to year two of our Following Jesus curriculum here at IPC, our Next Steps series of courses. If you were here for First Steps, so most everybody was here for First Steps. If you didn't participate in First Steps, well, if you did, thank you for doing so, and thank you for coming to hang out with us. That is a wonderful gift of your dedication this year to join us a second time. I would take that as a vote of confidence. If you were not here for First Steps, fear not. There's nothing that we did last year that is essential to having for this year. If you missed something, it will be okay. But if you want to know what we covered last year, and I think it was fairly helpful, and it will be helpful background for everything we're going to do this year, it's all available online on the church website. So just go to irvinepres.org, look for the adult education audio section, and all of last year is available for download, both the handouts and the audio files. So you can get all caught up if you want to. And you'll notice from my microphone now that we are recording again this year. So if you miss anything, you want to get caught up, you want to send it to a friend, sometimes we're going to cover material a little bit quickly, so you can always download, take it to the gym with you, or pass it on to some neighbors. If you weren't here last year, one of the things that I just want to highlight very quickly is that we are going to self-consciously use the language of course in here and not class. We refer to all of these as our next steps into the gospel's course and not just a class. And the reasoning behind that language, subtle as I know that it is that we want to communicate right up front that our purpose in gathering is not merely the transfer of information, but the transformation of our souls. That's what we're seeking. That our goal as a community is not just to make smarter Christians, but to facilitate the process of Christian maturity and Christian spiritual formation. And so for a moment, we're going to open with a quote from the Apostle Paul that I put at the top of your handout. This is his letter to the Ephesians, the fourth chapter. Paul writes, "The gifts that God gave," and he gave them, we're inserting here, "to the church," that's who Paul's talking to, "were that some within that church would be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, to equip the saints for the work of ministry and for building up the body of Christ, until all of us come to the unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to maturity, to the measure of the full stature of Christ. We must no longer be tossed to and fro, blown about by every wind of doctrine, by people's trickery, by their craftiness and deceitful scheming." That's Paul attacking some of his opponents there. "But speaking the truth in love, we must grow up in every way into Him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by every ligament with which it is equipped, as each part working properly promotes the body's growth in building itself up in love." So that's it's a little out of context to make full sense of, but Paul's writing to a church that's struggling with some stuff, and he's got some theological opponents there, and Paul's ultimate charge to the church is that they are to invest themselves in the work of growing to maturity. They must no longer be children tossed about to and fro. They must grow up into adulthood, into the full stature of Christ. And Paul obviously sees Christian theological education as a critical dimension of that. They must no longer be tossed about by every wind of doctrine. They must no longer be confused about what the truth is and isn't. But at the end of the day, the goal isn't that they become smarter in the gospel. The point is that they would grow up into the full stature of Christ, measured ultimately here by love. And so Christian education is essential, but only insofar as it serves the greater good of maturity. And that's what we're really after in these courses. And so what we're going to do over the next 9 months is some study, but study, as many of you who are here before know, isn't just the only thing we're going to do. Courses don't just lecture at you. Courses also have a lab section. They often have a practicum section. So there are opportunities to acquire content, but also opportunities to reflect on that content and to put learning into practice and see if the theory holds up. So over the coming weeks, we're going to study the scriptures with rigor, and we're going to work hard to understand what God intends to communicate. But we're also going to spend time in spiritual formation exercises. So beginning of each week, we'll gather together and we'll spend some time in prayer and in spiritual exercise as a part of stretching our hearts and our souls and preparing ourselves for transformation. We're going to spend some time in small group conversation most weeks, almost every week, so that we can build relationships and nurture our communal growth, and also have some time to move from abstract ideas to some practical conversation. As we did last year, we're going to set up an online discussion forum, so if you want to ask questions or you want to talk about things with one another, you can do that online. So I'm going to pass around two sign-in sheets. If you want to join the discussion forum, just give us your name and your email address. I'll make sure that you get an invitation to that. Once the invitations are out, you can join at any time. So if you don't want to give us your email address, you can sign up yourself next week. I'll give you the link to go do that. But if you want to do it the really easy way, just give us your email address and we will include you. This year, there's also going to be some opportunities for spiritual discipline above and beyond what we had last year. Annie Kirkby, I don't see her here yet. Annie Kirkby, one of our elders, will be involved in this course, is also setting up a Bible memorization program for anybody who wants to do that. She and a friend have done a bunch of this before. She's got a really great system all laid out, really easy to do. And so if anybody wants to take up the spiritual discipline of memorizing some of the scriptures, as little or as big as you want, Annie has got a system that she's got and is putting together for us, which will be great. We're regularly going to be nudging you towards service projects out there in the world. So it's far beyond just an intellectual exercise. I should note, I mentioned a second ago, the textbook recommended reading for this course is The Challenge of Jesus by N.T. Wright. A wonderful, wonderful insight into the message and ministry of Jesus. And we'll talk more about his book later on. Note always that we want your feedback. The goal is to do what's helpful to you in growing in the Christian life. So if something's helping, please let us know what's working. If something's not working, pretty extra please. Say it nicely, but tell us what's not working, and we will make adjustments. With that, let me turn just to a couple of introductions. I've mentioned the word we a few times. So the main people you're going to see up front, in addition to me, are Don Barkley sitting in the back. Most of you know Don. He's been a pillar in adult education here for years and years and years. You may not know that Don also holds a Master in Divinity degree from Dallas Seminary. He's on staff with Search Ministries. He's a constant teacher here, a constant teacher out there in the world. He's written the discussion guide for all the small groups that are going on church-wide. Has a deep passion for helping people communicate the biblical story to others in the world. During this course, Don is mainly going to be leading the small group discussion section, but in the spring, Don's going to teach one of our courses on the Christian worldview, how our Christian understanding of a reality interacts with other people's perspectives on things, and how we reflect on the critiques that other worldviews have of us, and how we engage with them in conversing about the gospel. Mark Russell, you'll see him up front in just a second. Formally trained in philosophy, holds a master's degree from Talbot Seminary in philosophy. But Mark is our resident expert in spiritual exercise. He has brought years and years of study and practice to the labors of the spiritual life. And so Mark is going to lead our spiritual formation exercises each week. Wendy Huntley, sitting right there, spent her entire adult life as an educator. She's an ordained elder in the PCUSA. She was our clerk of session for a zillion years. She's also our resident den mother. So you will notice if you feel any warmth or hospitality or just a sense that things were running according to schedule, that was because Wendy grabbed me and Mark and Don by the earlobe at some point and got us on track. Annie Kirkby will be here. I don't see her yet this morning, but she is one of our session elders on the discipleship and spiritual formation team. She teaches all over the congregation as well, especially in women's ministries. She'll be doing the work on scriptural memorization if people want to do that. Annie also holds a PhD in physics from Caltech. So if you you need help with your calculus homework, I recommend Annie. Another group that's here, we did this last year. Again, this year, we have a leadership development cohort for the year 2012. If you were a cohort member, you know who you are. 2012, raise your hands nice and high. Thank you. We have a couple more who will be here next week. They will be helping to lead the discussions as well. Those who are 2011 people, raise your hand, Rob, Jake's. We will be prevailing upon some of these folks to help us in the year ahead as well. So those are all the names you need to know. You'll get to know all of us better down the road. With that, let me turn things over to Mark. We'll spend a few minutes in prayer and spiritual exercise, and then we'll dive into the content of the Gospels. With our hearts a bit quieted and centered on God, we turn our attention to our studies for this course, an examination of the Gospels, seeking to build a comprehensive understanding of the message and the ministry of Jesus. That's what we're after in the next 9 weeks or so. And here is my personal goal for this course period, that when we are finished, you will feel that Jesus' words and deeds and character are aligned and make sense to you. Jesus' words and deeds and character are all on the same page, and they will all make sense. Now, this may seem like a simple goal unless you've actually read the Gospels. Because if you've read the Gospels, and you're anything like me, then you found it a maddening experience. I've found reading the Gospels tremendously frustrating. Now, you can tell me right now, if I'm alone in that, has anybody else found reading the Gospels crazy? Crazy making, frustrating experience. What's crazy making about it? That the Gospels themselves, that Matthew is different than Mark, is different than Luke. I mean, amen for that. Especially if you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and then you put them up against John. That is a very frustrating experience. We'll talk a bunch about that. What else is just maddening about the Gospels?
Paradox.
Say more. Right, turn the page, and Jesus seems like a different guy.
Yes.
So, other things, I think that's a particularly big one, but other things that just make you crazy about trying to read your way through the Gospels. Yeah.
All the parables.
Because it sometimes seems as though Jesus is trying to explain something by making it more confusing. Somebody comes and asks a legitimate question, and Jesus says, "Oh, let me answer that question by utterly confusing you." And even sometimes we'll say that they may go away having heard but not comprehended, right? Having seen but not understood. But I thought the goal was faith. Like they were trying to help me connect. And instead, you made it harder. Other stuff that's just maddening and frustrating and... Yeah. Right. Oh, you could. That's my own personal biggest gripe of all, is that you cannot predict. At least I have struggled mightily to predict. You read page one, you think, okay, what's Jesus going to do on page two? I think I got it figured out. And then you turn to page two, and the only thing that will not happen is what you thought Jesus was going to do on page two. Then you think, well, I've learned from page one, I've learned from page two. Page three, I got this dialed in. And then it turns out, once again, the only thing that will not happen is what you thought you had constructed of Jesus' character. So, for example, it's things like 1 minute, Jesus is forgiving a woman caught in adultery, but turn to a different page, and Jesus is saying, if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. But then he doesn't gouge out anybody's eyes. In fact, he finds some blind people and heals them, which might induce them to the very sin of lust that's going to get them tossed into the outer darkness anyway. And you think, well, now I'm confused. So seeing is good, seeing is bad. Seeing, all right, okay, well, never mind. Jesus tells one guy, sell all your stuff and give the money to the poor. And then, later on, a woman is going to come and take a bottle of very expensive perfume and dump it all over his feet. And the disciples are going to say, that seems like that was a bad call. Shouldn't she have sold all of that perfume and given the money to the poor? And Jesus says, no. What she did was exactly what she should have done, because the poor you will always have with you, me you only have for a little while. But the other guy, Jesus comes across Zacchaeus, right? The lying, cheating, scoundrel, ne'er-do-well tax collector, and invites him over for dinner. Zacchaeus, I will dine at your house tonight. Meanwhile, elsewhere, a really well-meaning young guy will come up and say, Jesus, I want to follow you. The only thing I ask is that you let me bury my father before I do so. And Jesus says, anybody who puts his hand to the plow and turns away is not worthy of me. Well, so the coward hiding in the tree, who's never done a decent thing in his life, gets dinner with Jesus, and the other guy who's sincerely trying and wants only to fulfill his Jewish obligations, Jesus tells him, I'm offended you would even suggest otherwise. Jesus says, forgive your enemies. And then he tells a parable in which the Son of Man and his angels will come and collect out of his kingdom all those who cause sin and evil, and they will throw them into the furnace of fire where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Okay, so forgive your enemies unless they're really bad or they're the wrong enemy. It's confusing. So if you've ever found the New Testament confusing or the Gospels confusing, I am right there with you. And the good news is I don't think it has to stay that way. I think we can build an understanding of the Gospels in which Jesus on page 1 and Jesus on page 2 and Jesus on page 3 are all the same guy. The actions, the words, and the character will all align. And it turns out Jesus is actually a very likable guy. I mean, that's part of the struggle is that until Jesus aligns and makes sense, there are parts where I think, like, I like Jesus on page 2. I would come to him when I was weary and burdened and heavy laden. But Jesus on page 5, I might think he seems harsh and critical, and I don't know that I want to build an intimate relationship with that person. And so I think that Jesus can make a great deal more sense. But much of what we're going to have to do to get there is we're going to have to return to Jesus' world. We're going to have to hear Jesus in his own time and his own context and in the language of his day. And so we're going to have to do our very best, and it will never be perfect, but we can do our best to place ourselves in the world of first century Palestinian Judaism, and that is going to help tremendously to make Jesus a more coherent character. So take hope that that is possible, and it's how we're going to devote our time to over the however many weeks we have. It's 8 or 9 or something like that. So this morning, what I want to take up, before we dive into the stories themselves and into this character of Jesus, I want to take up the most basic question of all when studying the Gospels, which is, what is a Gospel anyway? As we sit down and begin to examine these works, the first thing we want to ask ourselves is, what are we reading? What literature is being presented to us for our examination? And I think the most helpful way to go about this is to examine the origin of the written works as we have them today. Right? How did we get to this book that is sitting in front of us? And one of the first things we need to know is that the Gospels are what we call occasional documents, which means that there was something that occasioned their writing. There was an event or a series of events that caused somebody to sit down and think, these things need to be constructed. It wasn't just, Matthew wasn't looking for a hobby and decided at a certain point, you know, it'd be helpful to record some of what happened. There is an occasioning purpose behind the writing of the Gospels collectively and behind each one of them particularly. And we can reconstruct at least a little bit of that. And it helps us to understand the genre that we're dealing with. Why people wrote what they wrote in the way that they wrote it. Why is this the way they decided to communicate their intent? So we're going to hearken back for a minute to the earliest church. Get into the Wayback Machine. Head back to Acts chapter 1. Anybody remember the Wayback Machine? Is that just me? Oh, thank you. All right. Hearken back to those earliest days. I'm going to go all the way back to Acts chapter 1, right after the resurrection of Jesus and the founding of the early church. In fact, this is before the church even conceived of itself as a church. This is just a group of people who have been following Jesus, who has been crucified and miraculously raised from the dead. He has appeared to them a couple of times, given them some instruction, assured them that it really is him. And now there's just a group of people, a small group, men and women, who aren't sure what to do. Jesus appears to them at the very beginning of Acts. This is verse 6 of chapter 1, verse 6 and following. It says, so when they'd come together around the risen Jesus, they asked him, Lord, is this the time when you are going to restore the kingdom to Israel? Is this when you go on your final victory parade and you reestablish God's kingly reign on earth? And he replied, it is not for you to know the times or the periods that the Father is set by his own authority. But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses to Jerusalem, to Judea, to Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And so this small group of people, all they know is the day is coming when the Holy Spirit will come upon them and give them some power and authority, some measure of what Jesus has been displaying before them. And their job is to go out and bear witness to the world. That's the only instruction that they understand. And so how did the church go about this? Their job is to go bear witness, to testify. They're to go explain, to proclaim what they have seen and heard, and to help try to give other people some experience of what they have seen and heard. So how do they do that? First thing they do is they cower for a little while. But after Pentecost, they gain some boldness, and then what do? They physically start going out and proclaiming. So their job is to proclaim, and they literally verbally proclaim. And they do it beginning in Jerusalem. And slowly the book of Acts shows us the church begins to expand its realm until eventually it will stretch all the way to beyond Asia Minor, eventually into the European continent and on to Rome. And in the same way, we'll head east. It'll go all the way south down into the African continent, push east towards Persia. So the church is going to expand by people literally traveling and verbally proclaiming the message, which probably ought to be just a lesson to us. We all hate that idea of verbally proclaiming, but it's probably at least noteworthy that the early church did do some actual talking about the gospel. So they proclaimed it by speaking, which was a great idea for several reasons. Why was verbal presentation the smart play? Right. There was writing, but it was tremendously time-consuming to sit down and do it. It was expensive. Paper was not cheap. But even more than the efficiency of writing it was the efficiency of copying it. So even if Norman sits down and writes out his whole life story, the trouble is somebody's got to sit down and copy the whole thing by hand. So it takes way more time for two versions of Norman's story to circulate than for him to just tell. You could tell 20 people all in one moment. They can memorize a lot of it and take it out. If he's got to write it down and distribute it, that's going to be tremendously expensive. There's another reason. That's a particularly important reason. A couple other reasons why the verbal proclamation is smart. Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't know how to read, so that's a pretty important piece as well. Absolutely. Right. That is a huge bit. The thing that's going out is eyewitnesses to all or at least some of these events. Or later on, it will be people who are directly connected to the people people who've heard the story a million times, and the church recognizes them as people who are trustworthy passers on. But you have the opportunity for question and answer, and there's nothing like having an actual eyewitness give personal eyewitness testimony. I could write you. Well, I don't know if I could, but a good writer could write you a persuasive piece of content, but it will almost never be as persuasive as the person who is there standing up in front of you and telling you. Another reason that the verbal proclamation makes sense is because the early church thinks that time is short. The earliest church thinks that Jesus is coming back a week from Wednesday, maybe a week from Friday. So there's not the time to sit down and carefully craft out our literary explanation of what we've seen. You got to get out there and announce to people what's going on. So that's what we do. We move out and we tell the story orally in an oral culture, and it's the smart play by a long shot. But eventually, the church is going to run into a couple of problems. One of them is church growth. Eventually, you're going to get to the point where you've got more gatherings, more bodies of believers than you have eyewitnesses who contend over them. And so as people travel around, somebody takes the message on to the next town. Well, the people in that town want to know more, but there's not necessarily somebody to send to them to educate. And the person who told them wasn't necessarily a disciple or an eyewitness to these events. And so you begin to get to the spot where you need more witnesses than you have witnesses available for those churches. Secondly, we see this in Paul's first letter to the Thessalonians. Some of the disciples are dying. And so there's a point at which some of these people have reached old age, And those eyewitnesses are not going to be here forever. The thought that Jesus is coming back a week from Wednesday is beginning to shift to the church is going to be here for a while. And therefore, we need some preserved record of the authoritative witness to these events, something to live on beyond these initial disciples. And that's in part because there's some theological controversy, and we already mentioned that just a little bit in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, that there are people who are disputing which is exactly the right interpretation of these events. And so the disciples begin to realize somebody needs the authoritative word to live on. The Orthodox faith needs some codification. And so we begin to write things down. Now, on the backside of the handout that I gave you, we're going to talk about that writing process. I gave you a little snippet. There are three columns there that all have the same passage from, it's the telling of the Gerasene or Gadarene, which right there is something telling, demoniac. So give yourself, 30 seconds and just read all three of those columns. Okay, everybody had time to do that. So, what's the first thing you notice about reading those three columns? The same story. One in Matthew, one in Mark, and one in Luke. If you read it at all carefully, probably what you notice is that the wording is very, very similar, but it's not exact, but it's darn close. And if we were reading this in Greek, we would notice that they are stunningly similar in a way that is very unexpected. Greek is a cased language, which simply means that word order doesn't matter as much. That the subject and the direct object based on the ending of the word, not where they are in the sentence. So you could say the same sentence 10 different ways, 10 different word orders, would all mean the same thing in Greek. It's about emphasis and yada yada, that kind of stuff. When in Greek, you see the same sentence with the same vocabulary and the same word order in a language that doesn't require a word order to be the same, what's one thing you pick up on pretty quickly? Well, you could discern that it's true, or you could discern that somebody's copying somebody. Right? That somebody, if you got the same sentence in the same word order, clearly this is how the story is told. And it's told with these words in this way. And probably you have at least one written form in front of you because somebody's looking at the writing and copying down. And then they're making a little bit of changes along the way. They add a word, they take away a word, they twist, they shift a word just a little bit. All right. So this should not come as a shock to us that this is how it works. Because remember, these stories have been circulating in oral tradition by the time of the writing of the Gospels, for decades. We can date Jesus' death and resurrection to probably somewhere in the years 29 or 30 CE. So probably one of those two. Maybe it's 31, but it's somewhere in there. The first Gospels, the first one written was probably Mark, and was probably written sometime between 60 and 70 CE, somewhere in there. And it could go as early as late 50s, depending on who you ask. But we're just going to go with 60 to 70 because it doesn't matter for our purposes, other than to notice that it's been about 30 years from the time these events transpired to the time Mark, the first one, is actually writing them down in the form that we have them. That doesn't mean that Mark suddenly sat down and made them up. It means that they have been circulating for 30 years, and they have, in an oral culture, become standardized. That was a... If you're trying to memorize large amounts of stuff, one of the ways you do it is you standardize the stuff. You actually read the Psalms. You know, we have those acrostic Psalms. The first line begins with A, and the second line begins with B, and the third line begins with C, and yada, yada. Because it makes it easier to memorize. So oral cultures find ways to make things easier to memorize, and one of the ways you do it is you standardize the story. Okay. For me at this point, and in this case it was the story of the Gerasene demoniac that gets told the same way every time. For me, it's helpful at this point to draw a picture, but I'm a really bad artist, so we're in a conundrum here. What I'm trying to draw for you is a photo album and a shoebox, except that it's more of a photo basket. But we're just going to imagine that each of these is a Polaroid photo, just for... And this is... There you go. That's a Polaroid photo. So we're going to imagine just for a second that instead of coming up with a narrative work, instead of using words, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, their job is to put together a photo album. That's how they're going to communicate the story of Jesus. They're going to depict the life of Jesus in images. Now, when they sit down to create their photo album, they already have a shoebox full of photos available to them. They're not starting from scratch. The photos have already been taken. They have already been passed around for some time. So the basket of photos already exists, and each of them is a self-contained unit. So one photo may be the Sermon on the Mount, and another photo may be the parable of the Good Samaritan, and the other photo may be the feeding of the 5,000, and this one may be Jesus walking on the water, and this one may be Jesus taking a whip to the money changers in the temple. There's a basket of self-contained stories out there. So the task of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as they would have seen it, we're asking them what they're doing, it was not to compose a fresh work of art or even a fresh work of history. Their job is not to write an original creation. Their job is really editorial. Their job is to sort through all of the available photos, all the available stories, and to pick the ones that were most critical to communicating to their particular audience in their particular circumstance. Right? So Mark's got to figure out, what does my group need to know? What are the struggles that they're having? What's confusing for them? What do I need to be sure is preserved as a record of the gospel for them? And he's going to go through and he's going to pick various photos. Those are going to be Mark's photos. Matthew might come along and he might like some of Mark's photos. And say, like, I agree, that's a really important story for my group too. That's an important story. But actually, my group also needs those two. So Mark is... got his photos from the basket, and Matthew's got his photos from the basket, and you can bet that I'm going to use green to do the exact same. Like, some of them are going to agree, and then Luke's going to pick some of his own, and they're going to construct three different albums. And you'd imagine that they could put these in different order depending on the way they want to tell the story. So if I want to tell the story of my European vacation, I could put it together in chronological order and say, well, I landed in London, and then I went to Paris, and then I went to Florence, but then I went back to Paris for a little while. I could put them in that order. Or I could put all of the England photos on one page and all of the France photos on another page. And it'd be an equally legitimate way to tell the story. Or I could put all the churches on this page and all the museums on this page and all of the laying by the beach on this page. All equally legit. But depending on what I'm trying to communicate is how I'm going to organize things. But their purpose, this is the key, their purpose is the same. Their purpose is to preserve an authentic record of the message and the ministry of Jesus and to help their audience come to a conclusion about who this Jesus guy is. They're there to preserve an authoritative record of the message and the ministry and help you interpret that message and ministry to come to a conclusion, namely, that God has won his victory. I mentioned before that most scholars think that Mark was the first gospel written. Mark's gospel opens, you may remember, with these words. Mark chapter 1, verse 1. The beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The first gospel opens with the words, the beginning of the good news. Good news is just the English translation of the Greek word euangelion, which is where we get the word gospel. It literally refers to a proclamation of victory. It's a word you'd send back from a battle that says, good news, our side won, everyone can relax, and our soldiers have prevailed. You might hear an euangelion, the word angel or angel. An angel is simply a messenger, a proclaimer, one who is sent to announce things. So the gospel is the announcement of God's victory. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all have they're all writing in their minds gospels, the announcement of God's victory, and they're going to the basket to pick the photos that find a way to best explain for their group, and they've got very different groups, how it is that God has won his victory. We'll get geeky just for a second. If you don't like geeky stuff, it's okay. You'll never need to know this again. But just to lay a little bit of vocabulary on all this. So first off, our photo album then is a gospel. And we're going to mean that in a technical sense. So the capital G is the written word, the object, the gospel of Mark, the gospel of Matthew, which is in the authoritative account of the message and ministry of Jesus to bring the reader to an awareness of God's victory being won in Jesus. Each gospel, then, is made up of individual subunits, which we call pericopes. That's just the technical term for a literary, self-contained unit. So the feeding of the 5,000 as a self-contained unit is a pericope. And we're going to see that Matthew and Mark feel free to move it around in their photo album, depending upon where they think that story is most helpful in explaining things. If you go back, I would encourage you, if you get the chance, to sit down and read as much of like the Gospel of Mark in one sitting as you can. It's the shortest of them. It's the easiest one to read. If you get the opportunity this week, if you can read the whole thing in one sitting, great. If you can get close, great. One of the things you're going to notice, if you haven't already, when you do, is that these little pericopes are going to pop off the page at you, and you're quickly going to recognize when one ends and when the next one begins. It's even clearer in Greek, because there's little cue words that are the like, okay. And mostly, they all begin with like, and then Jesus went to another spot. And then we went and saw a church. Okay. And that one kind of ends. And like, the next thing you know, feeding of the 5,000. Okay. And then you can begin to recognize where the pericopes begin and end, and what the connective material that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John are writing to put them, the interpretive work and the connective work, is what Matthew, Mark, and Luke supply. So the Gospels are really edited assemblies of pericopes. This warehouse, this basket of photos, scholars typically refer to as Q, which is just short for the German word Quelle, which means source. So out there in the oral tradition, now we are oversimplifying at this point, by the way, so before you put this in your PhD dissertation, we are oversimplifying, but for our purposes, out there in the oral tradition exists Q. Q contains all of the circulating narratives about Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John go to Q. They take some of them, not all of them, but some of them, and organize them into these authoritative records, which we call Gospels. And here's how most people think that it went. They think that Mark was in black. So Mark drew his cards, his photos first. He wrote Gospel of Mark, which we give the shorthand G Mark. Whether Matthew or Luke wrote next is up for tremendous debate, and it doesn't matter. The thought is that G Matthew is G Mark plus what we call M. Matthew uses almost all of Mark in Matthew. You can find almost the entire Gospel of Mark in Matthew. Matthew just adds some additional stuff above and beyond, and we call the additional stuff M. So M is whatever I did in red. So G Luke, you can probably do the math, equals G Mark plus L. Because Luke took some other stuff. He also includes almost all of Mark, almost verbatim, different order, and includes some additional stuff from Q, and it turns out that M does not equal L. So Matthew and Luke both seem to have known Mark, but they don't steal much of each other's stuff. There's stuff that's just in Matthew, and there's stuff that's just in Luke, and there's a lot of stuff that's in all three of them. And the fact that we can put these things into those three sideways columns has been done for centuries. It's called a synopsis. And so Matthew, Mark, and Luke are often known as the synoptic gospels. That's Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because you can do that column-y thing with them. Now, John takes some of the same stuff as well, but as you know, John often puts it to a slightly different purpose. It is still a gospel. It is still an authoritative account of the message and ministry of Jesus, but John is writing at a later period than the synoptic writers are, and to a meaningfully different context. And so John is going to have to tell his story a little bit differently because he's got to accomplish some different goals than Matthew, Mark, and Luke did. All right, for now, what do you need to know most of all? I got three things for you. If you get nothing else, get these. First, it would be good to know that the written gospels that we have now are edited collections of oral tradition stories that harken back to the earliest days of these events. So the written gospels that we have now are edited collections of stories that existed in oral tradition that come from the earliest witnesses to these events. Sometimes you'll hear the critique, like, well, why can you trust Mark because it wasn't written until three decades later? And the answer is because Mark isn't writing a new thing. Mark is editing what existed for a very long time. Next, it would be good to know that the Gospels are occasional documents. Now, the Gospels did not fall to earth from heaven on golden tablets. They were edited by specific people at a specific time, in specific geography, for a particular purpose. And so when we read a gospel, we got to take that in mind. It's tempting whenever Jesus says you to think that Jesus means me. But Jesus was first and foremost speaking to first century Palestinian Jews. So I got to at least take, and Matthew, Mark, and Luke are writing to a first century, at least ancient Near Eastern audience. And so I have to keep in mind that there's some translation that's got to go on, some interpretation that needs to be accomplished. If we're going to understand the message and ministry of Jesus, we're going to have to enter into his world and the world of their authors, because these are occasional documents. I can't understand a letter that Mark wrote to Robert unless I know something about Mark and something about Robert and something about why they're talking to each other. Otherwise, I'm only hearing one side of a telephone conversation, and I really can't interpret it well. Finally, it would be good to know that the Gospels are not intended to be strict biographies or histories. The ancient Near East had those genres available. You can read ancient Greek histories. You can read ancient Greek biographies. Those genres existed. If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wanted to write a biography or history, they could have. The style was already there. The Gospels are their own genre. They are Gospels. And their main point is to announce God's victory. Thus, getting into hair-splitting arguments about reconstructing timelines and geographies is futile. Right? This is one of the things that every so often you have to read an article in Newsweek about why you can't believe the Bible, because the Jesus seminar told you that, like, look at all the contradictions. Why Matthew puts this story here and Mark puts that story there, and this happened before this happened, unless you ask Luke, and then it happened the other way around, and they use two different words to describe anything. But they're not trying to write histories. I mean, there's where you're going wrong. They're not trying to write histories. So they're trying to write accounts of God's victory. And in their telling of the account of God's victory, that's the main thing they're trying to communicate to you. And if they move the feeding of the 5,000 somewhere, that's not to cast doubt on the feeding of the 5,000. That's just telling you these people are not trying to write histories. If they wanted to write a history, they could have. They existed. They're not trying to write a biography. So what they're trying to do is to help their unique audience get a sense of what it was like to be with Jesus and what they're supposed to do in response to the good news that has been proclaimed. That's the goal of a gospel, to give you the sense of what was it like for those of us who were there. What did we learn? How have we been transformed? And what are you, next generation of hearers, supposed to do with what you've heard. And so that's what we're going to do for the next 8 weeks. We're going to seek to enter into the experience of those first followers of Jesus and to understand what it means now for us that the kingdom of God is now at hand.